You're going to love this. Just love it.
That's what they always say. Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles. This is your broadcast, as heard on 90.7 FM in LA, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the beautiful Oregon Central Coast, 93 FM WLRI in lovely Lancaster, Pennsylvania, KAKU 88.5 FM, the voice of Maui. And, of course, coast-to-coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, on the Stitcher app, the TuneIn app, on iTunes, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, and, of course, Radio Sputnik, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Glad you could join us today for, well, it's another action-packed, thrilling adventure, as it is every day here on the Bradcast, and we are glad you can join us for it. We have, before I start here, I have been welcoming our newest affiliate, KAKU 88.5 FM, the voice of Maui. Aloha, Maui. Glad to have you on board. I've been mentioning you, but I haven't given you a proper welcome, so I wanted to do that. Give you a proper aloha to the good folks of Maui, another great Pacifica Radio Network affiliate, by the way, out there located in Kahului. I think I'm saying it correctly. As per tradition, of course, we will be coming out to the new affiliate, broadcasting every day there for several months, just to, you know, as we always do. We always do that for every affiliate. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
By the way, our producer, Desi Doyen, are you ready to go to Maui?
Yeah, I am so ready to go to Maui. You have no idea.
I figured you might be. and by the way, is it right to say, you know, because I say coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, when we say coast to coast, that doesn't really include Hawaii, does
it? I think
they're
okay with that.
Are they?
Probably.
All
they
right.
Don't really have a choice.
All right. No, they don't. But at least they're carrying the broadcast every day. That's the important thing.
So exactly.
My thanks to Shaggy Jenkins and mahalo to all the good folks at KAKU for listening to us in Kahului, Maui. Who knows if I said it right? I don't. Like I said, we will have to go out to Maui to investigate. It's going to take some time. Hope that's okay. We would love hearing from you listeners out there. Of course, our email is bradcast@bradblog.com. And you can always also get our attention by tweeting at us on the Twitters. We are the Bradblog. As are we over on the Facebook. We are also the Brad Blog over there. If you're not following us, you should be ashamed of yourself. A lot of victories lately for environmentalists and environmental activists. Really, seriously, big victories kind of all over the place, from the Obama administration's rejection not too many weeks ago of Arctic drilling permits, to his rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline project, to several new investigations and possible prosecutions of big coal outfits like Peabody Coal. We discussed that on our Green News Report. Was that this week, Des?
Yes, it
was. I
have
lost track. It has been the past week has been just a blur. Peabody Coal got slapped with a, we'll call it a settlement. arguably even a slap on the wrist, but it's good to see people paying attention. The slap on the wrist from New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman for lying, Peabody Coal did, for lying to their investors and to the public about climate change. Also, new investigations into big oil outfits like ExxonMobil, as we've been talking about quite a bit lately on this show. So there's all of that, which seems to be good news for environmentalists. Also, Don Blankenship, the very powerful, or at least once very powerful, Dark Lord of Coal, as they called him. He's been on trial in West Virginia. He was the CEO of Massey Energy, the owner of the Upper Big Branch mine, where 29 miners were killed in an explosion back in 2010, I think, was it?
Yes, it was 2010. It was a couple of weeks before the BP oil disaster, which is why it lost all of the attention in the news once, of course, BP blew up in the Gulf Coast.
It was a huge story, actually, with 29 miners killed. Everyone was paying attention until BP came along and that explosion in the Gulf, which was so huge.
And killed 11 people.
Killed 11 people, but kept going and going and going for so many months that a lot of people really forgot about that horrible tragedy in the coal mine in the Upper Big Branch mine. And so CEO Don Blankenship, CEO of Massey, is now on trial. Is the trial for that specifically what happened at Upper Big Branch, or just safety violations overall for Massey Energy?
I believe it is for that specific explosion and that specific tragedy. And they're using his past, Don Blankenship's past communications as CEO, showing that he had little regard for miner safety and he put profits over his miner safety and actually pushed them to work with less safety and actually encourage them to not follow safety rules in order to increase production and increase profits.
So. Impossible. These big fossil fuel companies, they are looking out for us. They're looking out for the people. They are only concerned. I've seen the commercials on TV. They are concerned. They want to make sure that we have enough energy to make our coffee in the morning and drive to work each day.
They only have your best interests at heart.
That's right. And I can't believe you would even suggest otherwise, Desi Doyen. The Massey Energy was purchased by Alpha Natural Resources, and they have since declared bankruptcy, which is, of course, due to President Obama's war on coal. Everyone knows that.
And of course, no, it's not true at all. It's natural gas and fracking that are killing coal.
Okay. Well, that brings us to what we're going to talk about in a few minutes with my guest a little bit later in the program today, because there was yet another big victory for environmentalists this week, and arguably a big victory for the environment as well, I should add. But it was not, did not get much coverage. This was a big victory on Thursday, as yet another major commercial fossil fuel pipeline was rejected this week, even if it didn't get the coverage that, you know, TransCanada's proposed, now rejected Keystone XL pipeline received. Of course, that pipeline, that was just a week ago. Seems like forever ago, but it was just about a week ago that the Keystone XL pipeline was finally rejected by President Obama. He determined it was not in the nation's interest to ship dirty tar sands from Canada across several states, across a major drinking water and agricultural water aquifer down all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. But the victory for environmentalists was a pretty big one. This week, when a different fossil fuel pipeline was rejected by a different executive this week. How's that for a teaser? in a move that frankly seems to have surprised the fossil fuel industry, and it seems to me really could signal, along with the rejection of Keystone and all of these other victories, this could mark yet another turning point, a big turning point in the nation against fossil fuels and towards clean energy, towards clean, renewable energy. I mean, this was really a strike against fossil fuels and a strike in favor of clean, renewable energy at the same time. We're going to talk with Natural Resources Defense Counsel's Kit Kennedy about that big news that flew largely under the radar on Thursday. So I don't know. You may have heard of it somewhere else, but probably not because it hasn't been covered. Also, I want to get Desi. I don't even know if you know about this. The biggest entertainment launch of the year.
No, I don't know.
Is all about climate change.
No.
Swear to God. The
really?
Biggest, yeah. Do you know anything about this?
Well, I was going to say Star Wars, but I'm pretty sure Star Wars doesn't have anything about that.
Are you sure?
No.
We'll
because
find
I haven't
out.
Seen it.
We'll find out a little bit later in the program as well. So all of that is ahead, but there was some CIA news, two different CIA-related stories that I want to get to that sort of came out over the past 24 hours or so in an explosive revelation during an interview with Politico. Former CIA director during President George W. Bush's administration. That's not me calling him president. That's this story calling him president. During the Bush administration, the CIA director claims that his department informed White House officials over impending Al-Qaeda attacks months before the president received the infamous Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. briefing. Now, we've sort of known about this, but this is sort of filling in more details, it seems to me, and what happened in the months leading up, not just to 9/11, but to the warning in early August of 2001 that Bin Laden was determined to strike in the U.S. This is according to ex-CIA head George Tenet and Kofor Black, who was then chief of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. They had called an emergency meeting with National Security Advisor Condi Rice in early July of 2001, saying that they had evidence. They had evidence that an attack on the U.S. was imminent and that it would be, quote, spectacular. Beginning in May of 2001, earlier that year, Tenet and Black launched an initiative called the Blue Sky Paper, pitched it to Bush's national security team. This would have been just a few months, about 3 or 4 months after Bush had been sworn in 2001. The CIA called for a joint CIA and military campaign to end the Al-Qaeda threat. And now George Tenet says the word came back that, quote, we're not quite ready to consider this. We don't want the clock to start ticking, meaning they did not want a paper trail. They did not want to, have a record that they had said no to this or that they had, started the project but put it off for several months. So in July of that year, after receiving more confirmations of upcoming attacks, Tenet and Kofor demanded an immediate meeting with Rice. Tenet remembers that Rich Blee, I'm not sure who Rich Blee is here, but he started by saying, there will be significant terrorist attacks against the United States in the coming weeks or months. The attacks will be spectacular. They may be multiple. Al-Qaeda's intention is the destruction of the U.S. According to Tenet, Condi Rice said, well, what do you think we need to do? And Kofor Black responded by slamming his fist on the table and saying, quote, we need to go on a wartime footing now. When asked what happened after that meeting, Black said, oh, nothing much. He said, yeah, what did happen? To me, it remains incomprehensible still. I mean, how is it that you could warn senior people so many times and nothing actually happened? It's kind of like the Twilight Zone, Black said. And this is just amazing to me when we hear, because we hear it again. This is, I don't know how old now, 15 years at this point. But we're hearing now in the presidential race that George W. Bush, he kept us safe. He kept us safe. How can they even say that? Even if you make the best case scenario for the Bushes, that, who could have known there would be this attack? Even if they didn't know, there were still 3,000 people killed on their watch on that one day alone. But clearly they did know. Clearly they were warned. And we heard, for years, Richard Clark has been saying this. They were trying to get their attention. They were trying to let them know. And they were telling them, and they were doing nothing about it. Nothing. Putting it off. Okay, fine. That's what they did. But don't come back 15 years later, Jeb Bush, and say, my brother kept us safe. He didn't. He did the opposite. He was the commander-in-chief during the worst terrorist attack on this nation ever. And he was warned about it. And he was warned about it time and time again. And he did not take action. The administration did not take action. The administration did not keep us safe. They did just the opposite. George Tenet remembers a quote, "We were just thinking about all of this and trying to figure out how this attack might occur." Again, this is before 9/11. George Tenet, CIA director. How could this attack might occur? And he says, and I'll never forget this until the day I die. Rich Blee looked at everybody and said, quote, "They're coming here." And the silence that followed was deafening. You could feel the oxygen come out of the room. "They're coming here," he said. And then nothing was done. And so, you know, there's a lot of people who obviously, you know, for years, they could claim 9/11 was an inside job, this and that, you know, whatever, investigate. I never poo-poo any investigations of anything. Investigate all you want. I think that's fine. And I'm you know, always happy to see what information is out there. I have not been particularly persuaded by the inside job notion. It seems to me, what happened and the reason they were so seemingly covering things up after 9/11, making the president so unavailable to the 9/11 commission. You know, I think he testified for an hour in private, in secret, with Dick Cheney in the room. Contrast that to the 11 hours of open testimony that Hillary Clinton did a couple of weeks ago before the Republican Benghazi witch hunt committee in Congress. It always seemed to me that, you know, they had plenty of reason to not want to focus on what happened in the events leading up to 9/11 because they screwed up. They screwed up in a big way. And they're embarrassed about it. That seems to me the simplest explanation. And it is, you know, time and time again, underscored by information that we get of what happened in the lead up to 9/11. They knew about it and they took no action. That was the Bush CIA. And then there's the Obama CIA. This also in today, the CIA's targeted killing program has long been shrouded in secrecy. This is the drone program. Recent leaks given to The Intercept, as well as through reporting by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, have shed light on the executions of such attacks. But interviews with former CIA directors for an upcoming documentary puts the ethical quandaries of the program, which has few regulations, in stark relief, according to Justin Salhani at Think Progress. His report over there cites Leon Panetta and an incident who was himself a CIA director from 2009 to 2011 before he became the Secretary of Defense. He recounts a decision over targeted drone killing where innocent people were involved. He said that there was a situation where they had a target. They weren't sure what to do because this target was surrounded by his wife and children. And John Brennan, who left the he was the White House counterterrorism advisor at the time. He left the decision up to Panetta how to proceed. And he's quoted in this documentary saying the White House said, "Look, you're going to have to make a judgment here." So I knew at that point it was a decision that I was going to have to make. I'm the one who's going to have to say Hail Marys here. Suddenly, I found that I was making decisions on life and death as the director of the CIA, and those are never easy, and frankly, they shouldn't be, he says. But I felt it was really important in that job to do what I could to protect this country. So I passed on the word. I said, if you can isolate the individual and take the shot without impacting on women or children, then do it. But if you have no alternative and it looks like he might get away, then take the shot. And he said eventually it did involve collateral damage, but we got him. In the end, says Panetta, what you do has to be based on what your gut tells you is right. You have to be true to yourself, and ultimately God agrees with you, et cetera, et cetera. In fewer words, Panetta gave the go-ahead on a strike that he knew would kill innocent children. So they knew who this individual was. Panetta, you know, says he was a bad guy. He was, we don't know who this is. We don't know, you know, we can't check his work on this. He was clearly a leader who had been involved not only in going after our officers, but in killing members of our own forces in Afghanistan. But the individual had a family and wife and children around him. So the tough question was, what should we do? Well, what they did was apparently they killed him and his wife and kids. Now, that's not a war crime, I guess, according to Human Rights Watch, but it's because they were principally targeting this terrorist, I guess. It's an interesting moral question, though, and it's raised in this Think Progress article. Is killing innocent people, including children, an acceptable act of war? Defenders of the targeted killing program argue that such attacks keep Americans safe, but however, to date, there is no evidence that drone strikes have made Americans or any other human beings safer. There's just no evidence to support it. And we don't even debate it. We don't even have this debate publicly. In Congress. Congress has completely abdicated all of its ability to declare war, just completely abdicated that to the president. And then they want to criticize the president for not doing a good enough job. But they don't come out. They don't argue about, you know, where we should or shouldn't be in war, how we should carry out these wars anymore. Acting CIA Director Michael Morell said that the big picture is all of this, all of these attacks for which there is no evidence that we are safer. But all of these attacks are a great victory for us and a great victory for them. Our great victory has been the degradation, decimation, near defeat of the Al-Qaeda core that brought tragedy to our shores on 9/11. Really? But their great victory has been the spread of their ideology across a huge geographic area. Of course. So you got rid of Al-Qaeda, but now we've got ISIS, which is bigger, badder, stronger, more powerful than Al-Qaeda. How can that be possibly be regarded as a victory for anyone other than the people who, ISIL, Al-Qaeda? He says, acting CIA Director Morell says, what we haven't done a good job of is stopping new terrorists from being created. Oh, you don't say. And until we get our arms around that, this war is not going away. Right. And that's where we are. Former director George Tenet, who we quoted in the story about 9/11, said, you can't kill your way out of this. It's not sustainable. Well, it might not be, but it's certainly sustaining a whole hell of a lot of people in the arms industry, in the defense sector. They love it. It's certainly a big victory for them, if not for us. All right, a quick break, and we're back with the big good news. We have some good news today out of New York State. Stay tuned for that. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Welcome back. Back to the New York groove. Back to the Bradcast from Los Angeles. I'm Brad Friedman. Thank you for joining us. There was a big victory for environmental advocates in New York State. on Thursday. You might not have heard about it because, well, frankly, it received very little coverage nationally, and I think it actually deserves a bit more coverage. There has been a years-long fight over a pipeline, not the Keystone XL pipeline, which received plenty of coverage in recent years, leading to President Obama's rejection of that dirty tar sands pipeline that would have stretched from Alberta, Canada's tar sands down to the Gulf of Mexico. But this is a different pipeline, a liquefied natural gas pipeline that would have fed into Port Ambrose near Long Island and New York Harbor, the largest harbor on the East Coast, potentially disrupting commercial shipping, commercial fishing. Would serve as a security concern as liquid natural gas infrastructure has been regarded as a potential vulnerability to terrorist attacks. And perhaps even more of a concern, it would have threatened several proposed offshore wind projects that would have taken up the same space in these coastal waters off the coast of New York and New Jersey. Liberty Natural Gas's proposed offshore pipeline would have brought in natural gas in. It would have imported to the U.S. from Trinidad and Tobago, parts of Africa, and from our own Gulf Coast. But the project was vetoed on Thursday by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who, as it turns out, like other governors, and I hadn't really realized this, actually has the power to veto projects in federal waters when those projects are adjacent to their states. The governor said in rejecting this project on Thursday, he said, "This project presents risks to New York's security and economy while negatively impacting a critical renewable energy project." Those would be the proposed offshore wind farms. Together, he wrote, "These unmitigated concerns cumulatively outweigh the project's intermittent impact on natural gas supply." Here to decode all of this for us is Catherine Kit Kennedy. She's the director of the Energy and Transportation Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. She previously served as New York State's Special Deputy Attorney General for Environmental Protection and is a member of the Executive Committee of the New York State Bar Association's Environmental Law Section. Kit Kennedy, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Brad. Thanks for having me on, and that was a great overview.
Oh, good. I hope I got everything right. What were the main concerns? We'll get into some of these details in a second, but what were the main concerns about the Port Ambrose project from environmentalists up in New York?
Well, this was a classic David versus Goliath fight between dirty fossil fuels and renewable energy. And in this case, Goliath went down. Renewable energy has prevailed over fossil fuel, and it is a huge victory. So there were many, many concerns raised about the Port Ambrose liquefied natural gas terminal, which would have been located in the water about more than a dozen miles south of Long Island's South Shore. And local residents, elected officials, fishermen, environmentalists of all stripes came together not only to oppose the project, but to support an offshore wind project that was proposed for the same site. Both of the projects couldn't move forward. There was a physical conflict and just an operational conflict around trying to crowd both projects into one marine site. Mm. So all of these groups came together and raised a whole host of concerns that, Brad, that you summarized, concerns about security, concerns about fishing, concerns about shipping. And from my perspective, there was this crucial concern about whether this offshore wind project could move forward. And in vetoing the project yesterday, Governor Cuomo said the risks exceeded the reward of the project, and he cited all of those reasons, including the need to move forward with the offshore wind project, as reasons to veto the project.
As I understand, as I was looking into this, and like I say, it's kind of amazing that this hasn't gotten much national attention. I guess Keystone XL sort of sucked up all of the national oxygen. The media can only cover one environmental controversy at a time, I guess. But this pipeline, as I'm looking at it, it wasn't even for an immediate need, it seems. It was rather an anticipated need, if I understand it correctly, in the future. You know, as energy needs grow in New York, we've already got a natural gas boom in this country thanks to fracking. Why would we have needed to import natural gas at all from other, from Africa? What was that about?
It was very mysterious and hard to understand. As you say, there is a natural gas glut in the United States. At the moment, there's been a reduction, a steep reduction in the in importing LNG, and the New York State Energy Plan has noted that there's a reduced need for imported LNG. Yet this project was proposed anyway, so the need for the project was not supported. And was very unclear.
And in the meantime, you've got the possibility of a clean, renewable energy project in the same space. Are there any comparable numbers here? In other words, would this liquefied natural gas have been far more efficient, been able to power far more houses than any project proposed for wind farms offshore out there?
Well, it's a bit of an apples and oranges comparison, natural gas versus offshore wind. But what we do know is that New York has set an ambitious new renewable electricity goal. New York is aiming to get 50% of its electricity from renewable energy resources by 2030. Mm-hmm. And in order to meet that goal, we're going to need more of every type of renewable energy, more solar, more wind on land, and we're definitely going to need to tap into the strong offshore winds off our coast. So the need for the offshore wind project and other projects like it is absolutely there.
I was looking at, Natural Gas Intelligence, one of these industry advocate websites. They were talking about this project just 1 month ago. This was back October 14. They write, the clock now starts. I guess it received environmental impact statement approval from the federal entities in this case. They wrote, the clock starts now on a 45-day period during which the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie may comment on the project or veto it altogether. Liberty Natural Gas CEO Roger Whelan said, adding that he does not expect a veto from either governor. Well, apparently, Mr. Whelan was terribly wrong. So what happened there? How did that all change from 30 days ago when it was going to be smooth sailing for this project to the governor deciding to veto it? Or was Whelan just being incredibly positive to his fans in the fossil fuel media there?
Well, I don't think Port Ambrose fully understood the extent of the opposition to the project, the seriousness of the concerns about it, and the fact that elected officials at all level, community, legislative, statewide, were really concerned about this project. And you have to give a lot of credit to Governor Andrew Cuomo, who looked at every factor. He and his staff, as he explained yesterday, examined it from all sides, looked at all the arguments, reached the determination that the risks of the project exceeded the rewards, and went ahead and vetoed it very early in the process.
Yeah.
And so kudos to Governor Cuomo for taking that bold step, and his veto ends the project. As you were saying, Brad, under the federal law which governs this type of a project, the federal government makes the decision but needs to get the approval of the adjacent states. And if one state vetoes the project, that's it. So after Governor Cuomo's veto yesterday, the Port Ambrose project is dead in the water.
I'm speaking with NRDC's Catherine Kit Kennedy. Is it unusual, Kit, for a governor to veto a federal project like this? Does that happen a lot? I wasn't even aware that they had that right to do that.
So with this type of marine port facility, the federal law allows governors to veto projects, and this is by no means the first veto. First of all, a bunch of years ago, there was an earlier version of this same project proposed that was closer to New Jersey than to New York, and Governor Christie actually vetoed the project at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Governors of other states have also vetoed similar projects when concerns were raised. So this is not the first veto, but this veto sends a really important message, because there was this conflict between offshore wind and fossil fuels, and thanks to Governor Cuomo's veto, the offshore wind project can proceed.
Is this a turning point as you see it? We've had now within the past week two projects that, you know, even a year or two ago would have, you know, perhaps received just sort of routine approval. The Keystone XL and now this pipeline. Can we read anything into what's going on here, Kit? Is this a turning point? Is this some sort of a tipping point moment when our country, our elected officials are saying, you know what, no more. If we're going to do new energy projects, they are going to be clean projects. I realize you can't, you know, predict the future, but are we seeing something different here than we've seen in the past, Kit?
This is an incredibly exciting time to be working on climate and clean energy issues in the United States. And Brad, I think it is a turning point. We have all sorts of major decisions going the way of clean energy, from President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which came out over the summer. It's mm-hmm. going to require carbon pollution limits for power plants for the first time, to the Keystone decision, as you mentioned. And Governor Cuomo is just all in on climate and clean energy as we prepare for the climate talks in Paris. And you see local officials like Mayor de Blasio also stepping up the commitments to clean energy and climate. So, and this is not just in New York. It's obviously across the United States. So I think it is a tipping point, and we're going to see our country take strong action to fight climate pollution and to build up the clean energy economy.
Should environmental impact statements, the one we saw, for example, with the Keystone XL and now this one with Port Ambrose, in both cases, they sort of came back from the federal entities saying that, well, the environmental impact would be minimal. Is it your feeling, Kit, as an environmental attorney for so many years now with the NRDC, that these impact statements, should they be broader than they currently are, rather than, you know, just looking at the immediate risk to the immediate environment, which might be minimal, should we look at the broader global environmental impact, the climate impact? Should that come into play in these projects, or should they stay as they are, where they're just focused on the immediate environmental impact as you see it?
Well, definitely environmental review should include a thorough look at climate impacts, both the impact of the project in terms of climate pollution, and also how the project's going to fare if the world warms, in terms of resiliency to climate-related weather impacts. So that's a definite. Environmental review should absolutely be looking at climate impacts, and they're required to do so, and you're seeing, as time goes on, environmental review increasingly taking climate into account. So I think here with the Port Ambrose project, I don't think it's fair to say the feds had said there would be no environmental impact. I think the issue really was, when you lay out all the environmental impacts and all the other impacts, does the project provide a net benefit or a net impact? And again, Governor Cuomo found correctly that the risks of the project were greater than any possible benefit, pointing to all the concerns, the security concerns, the impact on fishing, and importantly, the conflict with offshore wind.
My, I've got one more item I want to toss at you here, but I know my producer, Desi Doyen, she's our managing editor on our Green News Report, which we syndicate nationally concerning issues of this sort. I know she has a question for you, Des.
Yes, Kit, really quick. I know that this this was a years-in-the-making process. Are there any tools or tips or advice that you have for other groups who are working on other local and state-level issues like this to try to stop these sort of large fossil fuel infrastructure projects from being started?
Well, absolutely. And first of all, I want to make clear, it was a great honor for NRDC and myself to participate in this battle, but the effort was really led by community and local groups who banded together and said, we're going to say no to this project. And yesterday I had the real joy of being in Long Beach, this beautiful small town community on Long Island, and the whole town gathered to hear the governor's speech and watch him sign the veto letter. There were school children, there were moms, there were activists, there were elected officials, there were fishermen. It was a great feeling of a town coming together with all sorts of state and local and national environmental groups to celebrate their victory. So I think the message here to others faced with similar projects is, first of all, don't give up. Don't think it's impossible. Band together. Reach out for other allies. And make your voice be heard.
And your joy at that ceremony was evident in some photographs. You were actually at the veto, and you could tell that the folks there were quite happy about that victory. Before I let you go, Kit, we spoke on this program yesterday with Sharon Eubanks. I don't know if you know her or not. She was the lead prosecutor for the DOJ in their case against Big Tobacco back in the late 90s and mid-2000s. We talked to her about the possibility of a similar case, a similar RICO conspiracy case against ExxonMobil. Now that we know that they knew about climate change decades ago and sort of obscured their own science, spent millions to mislead the public, Sharon Eubanks noted that some of the impetus for that federal case and the Big Tobacco case came from state cases against the tobacco industry. And now the question concerns a similar case against Exxon. New York Attorney General, and I know you worked in the New York Attorney General's office, the New York Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, has recently taken up some similar cases. One seems to have resulted in a settlement over the past week that really I see as slightly more than a slap on the wrist, if that much, against Peabody Coal, one of the largest coal producers in the nation, for lying to the public about climate change. And now Schneiderman is subpoenaing documents from ExxonMobil in an investigation as to whether they misled the public and investors. Do you have any insight on what the Peabody case might tell us about the outcome of a similar case against Exxon in New York under Attorney General Schneiderman? And is he really serious about accountability for these companies like Exxon?
I think the investigations that the Attorney General is undertaking are really, really important and really significant. The New York Attorney General has a very unique legal tool to use called the Martin Act, which allows his office to launch investigations into basically investor fraud situations, disclosure fraud situations, and in particular, the Exxon investigation is really significant, it seems to me, because there is information emerging which could suggest that Exxon knew the risks of climate change some time ago and did not disclose them and suppressed them. So that's the analogy to the tobacco cases, which Sharon was bringing out on your show. So I think the investigation of Exxon is really significant, really interesting. We'll just have to see where it goes.
But is Schneiderman's...
It's impossible to tell, you know, at the start of an investigation where it's going to go.
Well, of course. But do you feel he's serious about accountability? I mean, I was kind of disappointed, I must say, in that settlement with Peabody Coal. It, you know, it seemed like a slap on the wrist. Oh, just please don't do it again. Let everybody know you lied. And that was that. I'm wondering if a state investigation like this will be enough, or if we need to rely on federal prosecutors to take, you know, some real action akin to that big tobacco case a decade or so ago.
Well, Brad, I think Attorney General Schneiderman is very dedicated to climate protection. He's leading a group of states and cities to intervene in the challenges to EPA's Clean Power Plan, to defend the Clean Power Plan. He's using these tools in a very creative way. So I think he's absolutely serious. And we'll, again, you know, we'll see where Exxon goes. I do think the Peabody settlement is quite significant. And as to your question about whether the feds should be taking action too, look, I mean, I think that the Justice Department should be looking at these issues, and as well as other attorneys general. It's a moment to really focus on these issues, we'll just see where these investigations take us.
Well, Kit, I greatly appreciate your work on this, so I'm going to take some comfort from your confidence, at least, in Attorney General Schneiderman there as this case moves forward. Thanks for that, and thanks for the good work that you're doing out there. And congratulations, I think, are due here for your big victory. I know you've been working on this for quite a while to get that that liquid natural gas port shut down, and it looks like you have succeeded. So congratulations to you and all the advocates and activists out there in New York, Kit.
Thank you, Brad. It was a huge team effort, and I was honored to be part of it.
Thank you very much for joining us today on the Bradcast. Greatly appreciated. We will bother you again in the near future, I'm sure.
Please do. Thanks, Brad.
You bet. Thank you. All right, a quick break, and we are back with, the biggest entertainment launch of the year is actually all about climate change. Who knew? Well, you will soon. I'm Brad. This is your Bradcast. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here. And, we all have Star Wars fever. I know it. I know it's coming up soon. And Desi Doyen, you had guessed at the top of this program that the biggest entertainment launch of the year, I teased that it was all about climate change, and you guessed it would be Star Wars.
Yeah, that's because to me that would be the thing that would probably qualify as the biggest entertainment launch of the year. But hey, you know, okay, so I guess, is that it?
Well, that hasn't launched yet. So it could end up being the biggest launch of the year. But for now, it is not Star Wars, despite our shamelessly playing the theme song to make people sit up and pay attention. As a Vice is reporting, climate change is routinely called the biggest threat humanity's ever faced, but pop culture missed the memo. There still hasn't been a whole hell of a lot of climate movement in our most watched media, film, TV, or video games. But over the past week, we saw a bit of progress on that courtesy of Call of Duty. Yes, the new Call of Duty video game.
Oh.
This is Brian Merchant writing over at Vice points out that the most persistent enemy in the latest installment of the franchise is actually climate change. The game takes place in a globally warmed 2065. Players face environmental extremes wherever they go.
Oh, wow.
Dust storms in Egypt, floods and hurricane winds in Singapore, and so on. and Call of Duty is huge. You may not know it, Desi Doyen.
Because I don't play Call of Duty.
Well, I was going to say because you're an old lady. But that was...
I'm not a big video gamer, that's true.
This is... And now I'm going to get in trouble for calling you an old lady.
That's
it's because I'm an old man. All right. This series routinely beats out summer blockbusters at the box office. And it has nearly reached as many... has nearly as much reach as any fiction franchise going. And the latest installment is already the biggest entertainment launch of 2015, according to IGN and Fortune. It has pulled in $550 million in its first 3 days, which is huge. That's huge money. So they say, think of it this way. The biggest entertainment launch of 2015 forces players to interact with and endure a climatically transformed world in a reasonably realistic fashion.
Well, that is what they say. When I say they, I mean like cultural writers, especially people who are writing on, you know, climate fiction in novels right now. They're basically saying that's how you help people understand not just, you know, the science of it and the facts of it, but you help them immerse themselves in what it will feel like.
They say climate change is omnipresent in this game. It's an obstructive force. It's something you have to deal with constantly. You're forced to experience the environment that will likely come to pass if warming continues unmitigated. You will wade through floodwaters, wade out that dust storm. It will aggravate and annoy you. You are forced to feel climate change.
Interesting. Although you can't shoot at it and kill climate change, so I don't know how.
No, you
can. I hope it's successful, even if you can't, you know, have a first-person shooter response to climate change.
They say the more that audiences engage with the climate issue, which is notoriously tough to get folks to do, given global warming's pervasiveness and seemingly long unfolding time frame, the more that they have to deal with it, the more they might internalize and respond to it.
Well,
so
and
I
especially,
you'd be happy about
yeah,
that.
I am happy to hear that, especially because, you know, millennials, who are the bigger gamers anyway, folks under the age of 34 are going to be the ones who have to deal with the long tail of this looming situation that we have coming. So
well,
maybe that'll
that
be good to
nicely.
Give them some practice at it.
Indeed. It'll reach a lot of people.
Yes, and
I
that's
suspect
important.
They will notice. So that could have kind of a bigger effect than, you know, there's a lot of films that have tried to come out and deal with the issue, and they've kind of been box office flops, many of them. So this is going to get to a lot of people. Speaking of wind farms, since we were talking about offshore wind farm in the previous segment with Kate Kennedy, in Texas, of all places, wind farms are now generating so much energy that some utilities are giving the power away for free across the state of Texas.
Pretty wild, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really cool that they're saying that if you do your laundry, if you use, you know, your utilities after 9 p.m., this is someone in Dallas, I think, talking about this, that the energy will be free after 9 p.m. because they've got so much extra energy.
Right. Well,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's a neat thing that different utilities around the country are trying, which is what they call load shifting or demand shifting, where you let customers know, hey, if you can shift your energy use to a different time, we'll give you a better price. And, you know, it's off-peak pricing, for example. It's fairly common, but it's new to the utility industry. And it's both a good thing and a bad thing, in my opinion, because, you know, of course, at night is when the wind is very strong out in West Texas, where most of these wind farms are. What I would rather they do is store that energy in batteries and then use it the next day when they have peak, when they need peaker plants, which they only bring on at the last minute to just meet extra demand. There are plants that sit around in the country that don't do anything unless they're called on immediately to meet a peak demand moment, and they sit there unused. This would prevent having to build plants that take care of that peak demand. If you just store it in batteries, then it's useful for you.
Texas has more wind power, apparently, than any other state, accounting for roughly 10% right now of the state's generation, and they are alone among the 48 contiguous states in that they run their own electricity grid. It barely connects to the rest of the country. So they've got all of this abundant, as you say, the nightly wind power. You're from Texas, so you know about that. The abundance of nightly wind power generated here must be consumed here. It can't be sent elsewhere.
Right.
And so your suggestion, they make some big old batteries.
Yeah, well, you know, Tesla is now putting out a utility scale battery that is actually intended for utilities. That's their size. You know, you get a bank of those, and when you have excess solar or excess wind, you store that. And instead of, you know, say on a summer afternoon in Texas when temperatures rise over 100 degrees, everybody comes home from work, everybody turns on their air conditioning at the same time and really shoots up the electricity usage in places like Texas, then instead of firing up a natural gas plant or firing up a coal plant, you just basically tap into the batteries from which you've stored during a time when people aren't using it. But these are long-term transformations to
baby steps. Look,
yeah,
Texas,
this is baby steps. This is a great way to do it. It's a great way to get people involved and customers to think about how they can meet and exceed the clean energy economy that we're moving toward.
The fact that this great state of Texas is now getting 10% of their energy from wind, that alone is, I think, a victory. Wait until they realize how great sun works, too, down there in Texas, and how that's free.
Hopefully soon.
All right, last point before we get out of here. We have been talking over the past few weeks, of course, about Volkswagen scamming the emissions tests. They are in trouble. We had Steve Levine on the show a few weeks ago, who's written a book about batteries and the hunt for the holy grail of battery storage. He says that Volkswagen can save themselves by going pretty much all electric. That may be where they're headed. But in the meanwhile, if you want to send a message to Volkswagen, head on down to your Volkswagen dealer, because apparently they are not only slashing prices on all their cars, they are slashing prices on their electric model cars, like the e-Golf, discounts of up to $11,000 on the electric car. Yeah. Jetta hybrid prices slashed by some $6,000. So if you're in the market for an electric car or a hybrid car, you want to send a message to Volkswagen and, frankly, the auto industry, now is a great time to go get one of those cars at a really cheap price and say, yeah, Volkswagen, we don't want your fossil fuel crap anymore. Whether you lie about it or not, we'll take the electric car.
Say once you go electric, you never go back.
Well said. My thanks to Desi Doyen, our producer, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and to my guest today, Kit Kennedy of NRDC, nrdc.org. All right, we're out of here. We will see you soon. Until next time, you can download any of our programs at bradblog.com or over at iTunes. You can send me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. Or you can get my attention on the Twitters or the Facebooks. I am the Brad Blog there. Use #Bradcast, and I'll probably notice. All right. We'll see you soon. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.